Job chapter 4, where we'll begin this morning. It is certainly a beautiful morning. Me and my sister had to drive quite early this morning, and so I've been up for quite a long time, a lot longer than I typically would be on a Sunday like today. But nevertheless, that's allowed me to be more awake and be friendlier when I get here at 9 o'clock this morning. But you have been so friendly and so kind. This congregation has grown quite a lot since I was last here. And for that, you ought to be commended. And there's a lot of things that have changed, just a lot of new faces, and that's just wonderful to see. It really is. I appreciate the invitation to be back with you. This is the third year in a row that you've invited me to be part of your different speaker meeting, and I've just decided you can't find anybody else. So I guess that's the only reason I'm here. But sincerely, I appreciate the opportunity to be back with you. And I pray that this morning's class and the worship service is both glorifying to God, but also edifying to His people. So I need to set some context this morning for both of our lessons. And without this context, you're going to have some gaps in your mind that are going to be a struggle to kind of fulfill. And if you have these gaps, these lessons can accomplish their purpose. The two lessons I have written this morning are focused on a situation that me and my family have been dealing with for 2 years. This very week, 2 years ago, my mother was diagnosed with stage 3B colon cancer. And we mentioned, February 24th, exactly a month today, last month, my mother passed away from her battle with cancer. Her battle made me stronger. It made me think deeper. It challenged my faith. But her example through it all is what allows me to stand before you this morning. The sermon at the 10 o'clock hour will be filled with lessons that I learned while my faith was being challenged. But for Bible class this morning, I have something quite different planned. After my mother's death, of course, we had a lot of visitors in the next few days. We had the funeral. We had a lot of people there. And so we had a lot of conversations with people about my mother and people trying to comfort us through her death. But one of the things that was shocking to me was the amount of cliche and unwise things that are said to people in times of suffering. We have these hallmark sayings that sound great, and we might speak them with great intentions, yet their message is very untrue and oftentimes misleading. It can also be quite discouraging to those who are suffering as well. And so I searched through the book of Job and looked at his sorry comforters and realized that some of the things that Job's friends said to him are exactly the same cliche things that we might be tempted to say to someone else. Things that were not comforting in any way. So this morning I want us to examine the things that Job's comforters said to him and see 8 things that we should not say to those in pain. It'd help probably if I pressed the right button. I'm not sure if I am. Well, I mean, it's on. Apologize, technical difficulties, right? Oh, well, it's because the TV wasn't on. Sorry about that. No, that's fine. Yeah, we're good now. There we go. How about that? 8 things that we should not say to those in pain. And I hope this lesson is in the very least educational in the sense that you might glean a better idea of what you should not say. There are wrong ways to go about being a comforter. And this lesson will help us correct just a few of the bad habits that we might have when speaking to those in pain. So these are 8 things not to say to someone in pain. Number 1, do not say, follow your own advice. I asked you to look at Job chapter 4, and that's where we're going to begin this morning. Job chapter 4, let's begin reading in verse 3. Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak words. Your hands have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Eliphaz, one of Job's 3 friends who have come to comfort him, begins by telling Job he has been a great comforter to others and that Job needs to take his own advice. You and you are impatient. You can help others, Job, but you cannot help yourself. Job, you're a great comforter, but you are a sorry sufferer. Eliphaz is also suggesting that Job can dish out advice better than he can take it. Imagine how inconsiderate what he is saying might seem to Job. Of all the people that Job may have comforted, I sincerely doubt any of their losses quite measured up to what he has lost in such a short span of time. This is simply just an unwise way to approach someone in suffering. Those who have experienced intense grief, and many of you here this morning likely have. You may have lost a friend. You may have lost a loved one. Someone who was very close to you. You may have had to move away from your home. You may have had a lot of different things that have caused intense grief. But in those moments, let me ask you a very simple question. Are you thinking clearly and rationally? Are you very level-headed in those moments? Not at all. Not even close, actually. And so for us to try to come at someone with a very rational mindset isn't probably the best idea. And we need to consider that when we're speaking to those who are suffering. In these moments, nothing is rational for these people. And that's completely okay, and we need to realize that. And even though nothing is rational for them, we do not need to force them and force those who are suffering into rationality either. Do not say, follow your own advice. Many of us have probably before we were in the position of suffering. And we know, and one of the things I have learned is that the things I said to others initially were not things that were ultimately very comforting to me. It was a hard lesson to learn. Do not say, follow your own advice. Number two might come as a shock to you, but I'll explain it well. Number two, do not say to trust God. I know that one may come as a shock, but let's look at the text. One of the main arguments that Job's friends make for his suffering is that Job clearly has done something exceedingly sinful. Eliphaz does not make this accusation initially. Instead, he initially appeals to Job's righteousness. Still in chapter 4, let's look at verses 6 and 7. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? Eliphaz argues that if Job is as righteous as he claims he is, then God should take care of him, because when have the upright been destroyed? When have they been dismayed? When have the upright suffered? The way we might word this in our day and age is, well, God takes care of the faithful. You just need to keep trusting. And keep in mind, brethren, that when we say all these things, I understand we have good intent in our heart. We are trying to do what we believe is right. But what we believe is right is not always right. And what we believe is helpful is not always helpful to people. Say these things with good intentions, but I want you to consider what that statement means. That God takes care of the faithful and that you just need to keep trusting Him. What does that mean, that God takes care of the faithful? Based on New Testament thinking, I would not be comfortable applying that concept to physical well-being or suffering. I would not be comfortable applying that. Because what do we see the New Testament is all about? Is the New Testament focused on the physical? No. It's very much focused on the spiritual. The Old Testament is very physically based. The New Testament was very spiritually minded, very spiritually based. We do not see this concept being applied in the New Testament to a physical sense. James chapter 1 verse 12 talks about receiving the crown of life. So the faithfulness of God is conceptualized in that passage, but it is used in the framework of spiritual salvation, not physical blessings. Now, does the Lord bless us? Of course He does. We see that, obviously, in the numbers that we have here this morning. The Lord has blessed us greatly. But ultimately, God being faithful to us does not mean that He is going to save those that we love from dying, save those that we love from illness, keep bad things from happening to us. That's not what that means. God has not promised us, nor does He owe us, a life free of pain, loss, or suffering. So all in all, it would be unwise to say this statement, because you are likely sending the wrong message without realizing it. In these moments of grief, people want physical comfort, and by telling them this, they expect something physical rather than spiritual. My mother was a faithful years of her life as a Christian, the last 37 years of her life as a Christian. And when she was diagnosed, she made a vow that she was going to do the very best she could to continue to work toward the kingdom each and every day. She found new ways to try to help people, even when she couldn't be at services. She tried to call people. She tried to spend a lot of time with folks, and she did a good job at that. She strived to be as faithful as she could be, and I have confidence in where she likely is this morning. But in the moment of intense grief when we lost her, did that confidence help me a lot in that moment? Not necessarily in the moment. Because in the moment, guess what I wanted? I wanted my mom back. I wanted to hug her one last time. I wanted to talk to her. That's what I wanted. And when you talk to people who are suffering from such pain and loss, that's what they want. That's what they're looking for. So anything you say is not going to bring them the comfort that you are trying to bring. And I know on a sunny Sunday morning, these are not necessarily the topics that you expect to hear, but I do think these topics are important. So number two, do not just say, trust God. But number three, do not say, well, nobody's perfect. Look at verses 17 through 19 of chapter 4. 17 through 19 of chapter 4. Can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? He puts no trust even in his servants, and against angels he charges error. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth? He speaks of a vision that he saw in the night that startled him. Now, whether this vision is from God is unknown, but he feels the need to kind of dress up. Vision was from above. Eliphaz is making the point here that simply no one can be righteous before God because no one is perfect. And this is where he drops the first hint to Job that he may have done something to anger God, something that he must repent of. Under the logic that Eliphaz uses, Job could not help but offend God because he is simply not perfect. So from this narrative, Job must figure out what he has done wrong and ask God for forgiveness. And this ideology that Eliphaz puts forth is just unbiblical. In the patriarchal age, if something bad happened to you, you must have sinned. You must have made a mistake. We see this not only in the Old Testament. We see this in other religions. We see this with other idols. When Israel was worshiping idols like Baal, and they started to suffer, what did they think had happened? They had made the gods mad, and they would do horrible things, like child sacrifices. They would do some very radical things to try to get themselves back in a right relationship with the gods. And so not only if something bad happened, you must have sinned, but if something good happens, you must be righteous. And that theology is just not biblically based. We don't see it present other places in Scripture. We certainly don't see it present in the New Testament, because if that's the case, then why did the apostles suffer so much? Why did Jesus suffer so much? Why do we suffer so much? It's just unbiblical. And it also creates the wrong intentions in the minds of some. Well, if I am righteous, God will bless me. And this is exactly the type of mentality that Satan accuses God's people of in Job chapter 1. This is the mentality that he says was so prevalent on the face of the earth that people were only serving God out of their self-interest. They were not serving God because he was God. They were serving God because of what God could do for them, which is not biblical either. While I do believe that one can face earthly consequences for sins and pay a price for them here, the price will truly be paid in hell, or it will be paid by the cross. And that choice is completely up to you. God, once again, has not promised earthly blessings, but heavenly blessings. He gives us what we need to get us to the home we need. That's what God does for us. Under this thinking of Eliphaz, all of those who suffer from loss or pain are merely sinners deep in their disobedience, while those who prosper are righteous. And we just know that couldn't be further from the truth. We see a lot of corrupt individuals that have prospered greatly. And I know a lot of hardworking, faithful Christians that struggle to make ends meet. Does that mean that they're unrighteous? Certainly not at all. So to say this is to also accuse someone that they may have sinned and that what has happened to them is ultimately a consequence of their sin, which is not necessarily true either. And this all goes back to a point that I'm going to make continually throughout this lesson this morning, that we typically don't know enough about someone's suffering to speak about it. And that's why we should just stay silent. We don't know enough about it to speak about it. And when we make outlandish statements like what Eliphaz is doing, we're going to get ourselves in trouble very quickly. Do not say that nobody's perfect. Number four, do not say keep calm and carry on. And I'll explain what I mean by this. What I mean by this statement is that some will say, well, you just need to trust God and you just got to keep moving. You can't stop. You just got to keep moving. You got to start moving on. And people will say this with the intent that if someone in pain acts rashly, their decisions may have terrible consequences. They're trying to get people out of their irrational mindset because they're worried that if they stay in that, they may act rashly and that will result in some negative consequences. And while the sentiment there is true, let us once again consider the text. Job chapter 5 now. Let's look at verses 2 through 5. Job chapter 5, verses 2 through 5. For anger slays the foolish man, and jealousy kills the simple. I have seen the foolish taking root, and I cursed his abode immediately. His sons are far from safety. They are even oppressed in the gate, and there is no deliverer. His harvest the hungry devour, and take to a place of thorns, and the schemers eager for their wealth. Eliphaz warns of anger against God that could have some serious negative consequences, but his statements are pretty ironic if you think about them. Nearly everything that Eliphaz points to that could happen as a result of misdirected anger toward God has already happened to Job. Do you realize that? His home has been ruined. His children are dead. His riches have been taken. Everything that he claims could happen has happened. And this is why Job is so angry. And the fact that Eliphaz fails to see the irony in his statements shows just how abstractly he sees Job's suffering. He sees it as just another loss in the world, that he feels the need to go back to his book, Things That You Should Say to Someone Suffering. And I think we struggle with this because we see pain and we see loss and we see suffering so prevalent in our society today. I have been to probably 3 or 4 times as many funerals as I have weddings in my lifetime, my very short lifetime. I've been to a lot of funerals just within the last 2 or 3 years. I've known congregations that have had 15 or so funerals in 1 year. It's a lot of suffering. It's a lot of loss. That's a lot of people who are hurting. And when we see that time and time and time again, what happens? We kind of get desensitized to that, don't we? You know, we can suffer greatly and mourn with those who are mourning very well the first or the second time. But after the 3rd or 4th time, it may start to take a toll on us as well. And so we kind of push back and we hold people at bay and we kind of just see it very abstractly. Well, this is just another loss. It's a sad thing that's happened, but it's just another loss. Eliphaz does not know how to engage with Job as a real suffering being. We've got to learn how to do that. Each and everyone's suffering is very unique to them, and it differs greatly between one another. We have to learn how to engage with people as real suffering beings. And typically, those who do the best with that are people who have suffered themselves. But it's important to consider all sides in that. Now, once again, Eliphaz struggles with this, and this is likely because he does not know enough about Job's suffering to talk about it. And this is a common theme with most people's suffering, which is why we would just do best to stay silent. Job is angry. He wants to mourn, and his friend is just telling him to calm down and try to move forward. Is that the right thing to say? Probably not. Not going to be very helpful to someone in pain. Do not say, keep calm and carry on. But number 5, do not say that it happens to everyone. This is such a common statement that you might hear. Or you're at a funeral and you'll hear people say, well, I lost my mother too, or I lost this, or I lost that. And we'll explain just why those statements should be avoided. No sufferer wants to hear that their pain is not special, or that others are suffering too. Because not only does this do nothing to ease your pain, but it robs us of the unique nature of our pain and our grief. It robs us of our unique circumstances. When someone tells someone in pain that a lot of other people are in pain too or are suffering, that could easily be interpreted as, well, others are suffering too, so you shouldn't whine so much. That's how people take it. You don't mean it that way, but that's how people take it. Yet this is one of the most common things that I hear in times of loss. Look again at chapter 5, this time verses 6 and 7. Job chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. A man is born for trouble, as sparks fly upward. For man is born for trouble, as sparks fly upward. Job, do you not realize that this stuff happens to everyone? Everyone deals with pain. Everyone deals with loss. And that is what Eliphaz is trying to show Job. Everyone deals with these things. Ironically, we do use Job as the ultimate comparison of suffering. And we say, well, it could always be worse. And I do not think that Job would be very thrilled with that comparison. But going back to the statement itself that it happens to everyone, and this is the accusation and the point that Eliphaz tries to make to Job, that it happens to everyone, is that true? Does it happen to everyone? No, it's not true. It doesn't happen to everyone. My grandmother, unfortunately, couldn't be with us this morning. My mom's dad is currently in the hospital, and so she is there with him in Birmingham this morning. But my grandmother had to bury her daughter. Had to bury her daughter at 51 years old. And she didn't expect to do that. It's not generally the way that the order goes. It's typically the children that bury their parents. Me and my sister both knew that there would come a time that we would have to bury our parents. But we did not think it would be this soon. My grandmother never saw the day that she would bury her daughter. Does that happen to everyone? It doesn't. It doesn't happen to everyone. Typically, if we live to see it, we will likely all lose our parents. Some of you may even lose your children. Many of us will at least lose friends and loved ones if we live to see that point. But does that mean that all losses are the same? Or all losses are even remotely similar? I had a lady tell me yesterday that she lost her mom at a similar age as my sister and I. And that she knew exactly what we were going through. I thought to myself, do you? You know exactly what we're going through? Because her relationship with her mother was likely different. And the ultimate point in all that is that we need to allow these situations to be unique to each individual. And the fact that her relationship with her mother was likely different makes her suffering different. Even the relationship that I have with my mom is different from the relationship my sister had with her. That makes our suffering different in some regard. My dad is also here with us this morning. The suffering that he is feeling losing a spouse is far different than me or my sister's suffering. Each suffering is unique to the individual. And we do need to allow people's pain to be unique. These things simply just do not happen to everyone. And so that statement must be avoided. We try to say that with some sort of comfort. Like other people have dealt with this, you can deal with it too. But once again, in the moment of irrational thinking, that is not the wise thing to say. Do not say it happens to everyone. Number six, another one that may come as a shock to you. Do not tell people to pray. Likely many of the people that we will be conversing with are Christians. So let's keep that as our generic example for this morning. That we're talking to Christians, members of the Lord's church, because there are some circumstances in which we will have to vary from this template to some degree. But Job was a righteous man, and Eliphaz is talking to a righteous man, so I think we should use that as our example for this morning. But the idea of just telling someone to pray, that's such a generic Sunday school response. Well, you just need to pray. Well, just pray and things will get better. To make that statement to someone who is a devoted disciple of Christ, it almost comes across as an accusation that the afflicted have not been praying, which is an accusation that I recommend you do not make to someone suffering. I have never prayed so hard in my life as when my mother was in the hospital. I have never prayed that frequently and that intensely. And I likely couldn't replicate that if I tried, nor would I want to. But I was praying as hard as I could. And yet I still had statements, well, you just need to keep praying. You just need to pray. Do you not think I have? Are we assuming that people aren't praying? I know sometimes people do struggle with their prayer life. But in times of suffering, I mean, I've seen non-believers, even atheists, that will consult prayer. So to assume that someone's not praying is a heavy accusation to make. And number two, with what Eliphaz is saying, he's saying this to Job in chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. It is once again so ironic because Job's speech that he is present for in chapter 3 is primarily a prayer to God. Prayer is a word that has not always primarily been religious in nature. The word in Hebrew, from what I read, so take that with a grain of salt, means to petition or to think toward. What that vague definition tells me and allowed me to conclude is that what Job is doing in chapter 3 and speaking toward God is just as much prayer as Nehemiah's prayer in chapter 1. Now, do I think Job says and takes the wrong attitude in some of his prayers? Yes. Does not mean his prayers were perfect. It doesn't make it any less a prayer. And so Job was praying to God. Job will petition or pray to God as the book goes on. Prayer itself was not a lacking area for Job, which makes the advice given pointless and accusatory. It's making the accusation that Job isn't praying. To make such an accusation or claim to someone in pain is not wise, and it must be avoided. Do not simply say to pray. Number seven, do not say God is testing you because he loves you. The New Age terminology that you'll see on Facebook is that God gives his toughest battles to his strongest soldiers. We probably all have seen that at one point. Whoever came up with that had to brand with Hallmark immediately, because that has sold well over time. It has. Not only has the religious world very much bought into that, the church has bought into that. Let's consider that statement. Is that necessarily true? Well, let's find out. Eliphaz earlier told Job that his suffering was not special, but apparently he's reserved the right to change his mind. Because at the end of his speech in chapter 5, he suggests that those who suffer, or suffer specifically at the hand of the Lord, are special indeed because these are the ones that God loves the most. Look at chapter 5, verse 17. Behold, how happy is the man whom God reproves. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. His logic seems to exist somewhere between there's no such thing as bad publicity, and this hurts God more than it hurts you. It kind of lands somewhere in the middle of all that. By paying attention to Job and caring enough to discipline him, God is showing him how much he loves him. That's what Eliphaz is saying. And this statement is rooted in all sorts of misinformation due to the lack of knowledge Eliphaz has on this subject, which is a common theme over and over. He does not know enough about Job's suffering to speak. Therefore, he should not. He's assuming, number one, that this is God's doing. God is disciplining Job. This is God's doing. Which is it? Is this God doing this to Job? No, it's not. Satan is the one who has done this to Job. So he makes a wrong accusation, first and foremost, in attributing this to God. God didn't do this to Job. Satan did this to Job. He's also assuming that this is discipline for something Job did wrong. Is it? It's not discipline at all. Because Job was a righteous man. He had not done anything, at least that the scripture has pointed out to us, to lead up to these events. Satan has done this to him, and this has certainly not been for discipline's sake. The misinformation makes the statement faulty, but what about with us? We know that some Christians have tougher lives than others. There are people out there who've got far tougher, likely, than I do. But why is that? I'm not sure. But I can tell you what I don't believe this has to do with. I don't believe this has to do with who's the strongest soldier either. I don't think it has to do with that. To those who have not faced much suffering, they may feel inferior to such a statement. Well, am I not a strong soldier? I may not have faced such pain or loss or difficulty in life. Does that mean I'm not a strong soldier? Does that mean I'm not a soldier in the Lord's army? As Jesus told Peter about John, if he remains till I come, what is that to you? Our lives as Christians are not to be put up to comparison with one another. We must avoid that at all costs. Yet we do it all the time. We see someone and we say, well, they've just got such a tough life. But what are you comparing that to? You're comparing it to your own. Well, they've just got such an easy life. Well, what are you comparing that to? You're comparing it to your own. So we do these comparisons 24/7, likely due to the competition and competitive nature that we have with one another. But that should be avoided. Lastly, on this point, and we'll talk about this in the next service, we typically do not know the root of our suffering either, which makes a statement like this dangerous. To attribute to God what is not God's. To call God out for something that He has done that God has not done. That's dangerous to do. And to say, well, God has disciplined you, or God has made a mistake, which oftentimes is said, well, God made a mistake in taking them. He shouldn't have done that. Well, you shouldn't attribute to God what isn't God's. Who did this in this story? Satan did this. Brethren, we very much believe that God does a lot for us. We also sometimes lack the belief that Satan has a hand in this world. He won't have a hand in the next one, but he does have his hand in this one. And when he can't keep you from being here on Sunday morning and Sunday night, when he can't keep you from being devoted, when he can't keep you from reading your Bible, when he can't get you out to the bar on Friday night and Saturday night, when he can't keep you from being immodest, what is he going to do? He'll take what you love instead. He'll go after you in other ways. He'll take what motivates you, what drives you, what you love, and he'll take it from you. Because in the same way he was trying to do to Job, he was trying to get Job to curse God and die. That's what he's trying to get us to do too. We need to remember that Satan has his hand in this world. Even in that, it's not necessarily to say that Satan has done this to us. What does Ecclesiastes teach us? Time and chance happen to them all. God has appointed a time to be born and a time to die. These things happen. God has appointed nature to take its course. And unfortunately, things happen. So we need to accept the uncertainty of our suffering. And don't attribute to God what is not God's. Do not say God is testing you because he loves you. But lastly, number 8, do not say it's all going to be okay. We must remember that Eliphaz is a friend. He's a friend who's trying to do his best to comfort someone who's virtually inconsolable. He ends his speech the way most would, with an affirmation that everything will work out in the end according to God's plan. Look at chapter 5, verses 22 through 27. Let's read those. Chapter 5, verses 22 through 27. You will laugh at violence and famine, and you will not be afraid of wild beasts, for you will be in league with the stones of the field, and the beast of the field will be at peace with you. You will know that your tent is secure, for you will visit your abode and fear no loss. You will know that your descendants will be many and your offspring as the grass of the earth. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like the stacking of grain in its season. Behold this, we have investigated it, and so it is. Hear it for yourself. Eliphaz paints this beautiful utopian end where God personally cares for and looks after Job. And in this vision, everything has returned to the way it once was, and Job would die of old age after a long and prosperous life. Such comforting words, right? Job doesn't agree. Job does not agree. He repeats the line that he repeats in chapter 3, that he wishes he would perish, and he begins to take his original statements that he made in chapter 3, and he takes them a whole lot further this time. Has Eliphaz said anything to comfort Job? No. If anything, he has made it worse. He has not helped his friend. He has made it harder on his friend. Even the hope of a future reward from God was not enough to console Job in the moment of his distress. And that's important to consider. That's important to consider. In these moments, it is easy for us as an outsider to look at someone who's dealing with such intense grief or pain or loss and say, do you not believe? Do you not believe in the promises of God? Do you not believe in heaven? Do you not believe in the resurrection? The reality is, Job did likely believe in the ultimate reward from the Lord, but that did not stop his grief, nor should it have. Jesus knew that Lazarus was about to be raised from the dead. That didn't stop him from crying. Didn't stop him from weeping. Eliphaz was rational, but Job was not in the mindset to accept such a rational answer. He was upset, He was distraught. He was unrelieved. He was weary. He was restless. He was anything but rational, and most people will be in grief, and that's okay. That is okay. Many times, brethren may appeal to a passage like Romans 8:28, which says, all things work together for those who love the Lord, and that God will make everything work out in His time. Well, that's an appealing sentiment. The passage is proof texted if it's read that way. In Romans 8, Paul's connecting the context of the passage to all the things that God is doing and all the things that He has said beforehand in Romans about sanctification, about justification, the work of the Spirit, baptism. All these ideas that Paul has mentioned is what he's connecting. Those are the things that intertwine and work together for our spiritual good, not our physical good. I can't look at the death of my mother and see any good that has come out of that. I can't. And you might say, well, that's just naive in nature. You just haven't had enough time to see that. Well, I had a best friend that committed suicide 5 years ago. Hadn't seen anything good come out of that either. To say that all things work together for good, that's not what Romans 8:28 means. That's not contextually right in that passage, nor should that be a comforting statement that we should give to someone. These are why atheists get such wild ideas about childhood cancer, about tragedies, about loss, because we say things like this, and they ultimately take that and they say, well, this is supposed to work out for good? How? Well, not everything works out for good. That's not what the passage is implying. It's our justification, our sanctification, the work of the Spirit. Those things work for our spiritual reward. And it is in those three realms, not all things, that it is such as applied to in the world. The fact is that some things just happen, and not all of them can contribute or work necessarily for good. Now, can we take a bad situation and learn from it? Of course we can. But I'm still always going to have a hole in my heart where my mother was. That hasn't necessarily worked out for my good. It's a catch-all statement that we like to make, but it doesn't catch all. Do not say it would all be okay, because for some people it really never is anymore. My grandmother will always miss her daughter. Me and my sister will always miss our mom. Are things exactly the way it was before? Is it necessarily okay in our minds? Not at the moment. And it will never be the same. My grandmother would likely never feel okay with that. And so we need to avoid such statements like that. We have to be careful with our words. Because when we say things like that to people, what we unintentionally do is we minimize their pain. We minimize their loss. And we say, well, it doesn't matter what you've lost. It's going to be okay. That's just not the wise thing to say. And we need to realize that. We have to be careful with our words. And these are just 8 things that we learned from this first speech of Eliphaz that we should not say. I thank you for listening so patiently. I know what you're thinking, though. I took every line from you that you might say to a suffering soul. So now you're thinking, what should I say? Or should I speak at all? And we're going to answer that question in the next lesson. Unfortunately, in this story for Eliphaz, he speaks out of a perceived need to say something at a time when listening and showing love was likely his best response. That's what he should have done instead. His comments at best are shallow and condescending, and his failure to comfort Job can learn us how not to treat a suffering friend. Nearly everything that he said fits into a comfortable range of things that we may be tempted to say to someone who's experienced extreme pain or profound loss. These are not bad things to say. He does not speak in a cruel or unsympathetic way. He simply insists on speaking when there's nothing he can say. And that's what we need to realize about these statements. They're not necessarily bad things to say. They're just the wrong things to say. And when we insist on speaking at a time when we should just stay silent, they are bad things to say about these statements. Before we ever follow his example, let's consider how our suggestions might sound. And let us choose to simply just stay silent and to be there for those who need us and for those who are suffering. The only time I'm going to ask you not to stay silent is, we're not going to have an invitation song here in the Bible class hour, but if you need to become a Christian, I'd ask you don't stay silent right now. You can see us the moment that I decide that this is over in just a second. You can see Brother May. You can see any of the members here. And we can take care of that. I can't think of a better way or a better reason to postpone worship service than for a baptism or for a restoration or for prayer for the congregation. I can't think of a better reason. So if you need to do that, then the moment this is over, please see somebody. And let's take care of that this morning before the worship service ever even begins.